We're talking about, of the 75 miles plus that were oiled, probably less than a half a mile that still has this presence of oil. But certainly a couple of the locations where we had no trouble finding the oil at all. It was Bunker C. It was a different type of product. But we think that looking at the beach types and the areas where this remaining oil was, we can make some comparisons that are going to help us over the winter in looking at some of the locations in Exxon Valdez in terms of predicting how much oil we think will be left. One of the things, though, that was, I thought, fascinating about our discussions with Vandermeulen as he's watched this thing over the last 20 years is as he's watched the progress of the recovery. By the way, I should mention, I was not aware, I don't know how many here in this room were, that in the Arrow spill they used BP 1100 dispersants on the beaches, and there is a written report from that. I hadn't heard of it. I also was not aware that a majority of the 75 miles, at least half, if not more, of the 75 miles of impacted coastline were never clean. They were left alone. So the recovery's been natural there in that site throughout the whole process. But Vandermeulen's discussions with us were encouraging, actually. When we first got there, I think Admiral Cianglini and I both reacted pretty strongly to the quantity of oil we saw where we saw it, and immediately began to be more concerned than, certainly I began to be more concerned looking at that compared to what maybe I had been in some of the overall prognosis. But interestingly enough, Vandermeulen was of the opinion that that remaining oil was not really causing much of a problem other than aesthetics and loss of habitat where the oil actually was and there couldn't be growth. He was not seeing any significant damage in the persistency of this oil. He's written several reports to that effect, but actually was a very, very strong vocal proponent, I guess, of the fact that that oil was not causing any significant damage. We intend to go to France. There is a site in Olympic National Park on the Washington coast, which has some of the real large rock, heavy cobble, deep penetration of oil from a spill last Christmas that hasn't been mentioned much, I think, when people have tried to do some comparisons. But I think from being involved in that spill and seeing a lot of the different types of beach here, probably is significant, and we intend to visit, and I would encourage any others that are looking especially at areas where we know that we've got some real deep penetration of oil. We have the very same thing there in that section of Olympic National Park, and I think it's going to be a real nice comparison. Any of you that may be also looking, I think, ought to plan on going to that section of beach. Be happy to give you details on where you would go to do that. But it's a very remote, pristine section of the Washington coast. I think I may have come to the end of what I had to report. You have something else, two things probably before I quit. We will establish an office with the Coast Guard over in the Key Bank building. The Coast Guard has been kind enough already to set aside an office space for us. We will intend, depending on the workload, and certainly in the beginning, to have someone man that full time. That person probably, will be Dr. John Whitney, who is a local scientific support coordinator here. He's actually going to be asked to live in those spaces. He will have an assistant, Joe Talbot, who is presently in Kodiak working on the winter studies program for outside of Prince William Sound. Talbot will come back here, though, and spend the winter as his assistant. So we'll have people here full-time, two people here full-time, working on the Exxon Valdez. John Robinson, myself, Sharon Christofferson, at a minimum, intend to be at all the significant major meetings, and we'll be spending some time on the beaches ourselves throughout the winter also. Did I miss anything you wanted?
No, not at all. I just wanted to elaborate on one point, Dave, and that had to do with the motor vessel Arrow from a layman's point of view, and I am a layman, and there's the scientist over there. I'll tell you what I saw. The beach that where they didn't bother to clean up, there was a low-energy beach, very little wave action, very little. And the oil must have been probably about that that thick when it floated up onto the beach, up in the high area where you didn't have much wave action at all, just a lot of wind, a lot of sun, and whatever else is up there. You had a light asphalt on the rocks, and you could hardly scrape it off. It was embedded so hard on it. And then as you worked your way closer to the water where the surface was warmer, there you ended up into you ended up with asphalt that thick that you could hardly put a pick into. We had a pickaxe with us, and you could hardly put a pick into it. And as we worked our way closer to the water, then all of a sudden you can put the pick into it, and the asphalt would break off and crumble. And then you got closer to the water, and then you would have tar, which you can put your thumb and just push it. It's spongy. And you had tar oozing up from it. And then as we got closer to the water and maybe hitting the water there in some spots, there you saw some 8-inch pancake type of oil patties there. And then you saw the wormholes, and you saw the hydrocarbons, petroleum product coming up there, and you can still see the rainbow sheen. Now that is a beach that was they made a conscious decision not to clean it at all. And I say for us, fortunately, we went out and got as much of the oil off as we possibly could within the time that we had. Now that's Bunker C, and I don't know how closely that relates to the crude oil that we had here. It's a thicker, different type of oil, but that's what we're looking at. And on the other side of Chedabucto Bay, the high energy beach where the waves were crashing throughout the winter. And that area there is every bit as harsh as it is here. There we saw the beaches were clean. Although up to about 6-8 years ago, there was still some oil underneath the rocks. And we saw some littorina underneath the rocks, even in the heavily encrusted areas that were still there. So that is what we saw. We got a really nice contrast there. And what I found interesting, Dave, I would prefer that you speak to it, is where we went to one place where it was apparently clean, and yet the oil was sliding. And I can't talk the technical talk if you can.
Well, the majority of the area, though, that was left alone cleaned itself very quickly. But these were a couple of unique spots, and it was certainly impressive where the amount of oil that remained in those locations.
In a couple of weeks, Mr. Kennedy and I will be going to France to look at the Amoco Cadiz case. Somebody has to go, you know. But in any case, no. That one there is a 50 million gallon spill. That's five times larger than the Exxon Valdez spill. Five times larger. Now, the beaches there are clean. We know that. But we're going to go over there and purposely look at those beaches and converse with the people who we're going to try to converse with the people who controlled the cleanup. We do have an interpreter who controlled the pickup, and the people who were most the scientists over there who were involved with it. Again, as I told you before, we're particularly interested, at least I am, and Dave is probably interested from another viewpoint in addition to mine, what it was like in the aftermath of the following winter. What it was like, what was it consisting like, what did they do to clean it up? So I didn't want to get into any big elaborate things, but just saying, we're moving, we're trying, and we're going to share this information with everybody, and whatever information we have.
Pam? Can you tell me more about when the sites will be identified for the Gulf of Alaska? How many will be?
I can't tell you more. Talbot can, and I'll make sure. I think you converse with him occasionally, and I'll certainly have him get that word out. He only had a draft plan available. I just spoke to him briefly yesterday as I arrived in town, and he was headed back to Kodiak to finish up his work there. So I'm not very familiar with the plan either, except that we decided we definitely needed to do more in looking outside the sound than we had initially planned.
I was wondering if the response, Interior sent a comment letter to, in the FOSC a couple of weeks ago, mm-hmm. and suggested some sites.
I don't know if they're included. We need to check, and we'll make a point of doing that. Yes.
I read all those reports on the Chedabucto spill in Chedabucto mm-hmm. Bay, and mm-hmm. I know as of 5 years ago, which would have been 15 years after the spill, we're still finding the clam populations were considerably depressed over areas that hadn't been oil, where there was oil. So this, there must have been quite a bit of recovery in some of those areas since then.
Well, I think there has been. I'm not familiar with that particular report, and I have not read them all. Do you know who did the reports? Whether
I can't tell
it was a Van Mullen?
We have them all in our library. Mm-hmm. There was quite a series of reports. And there was a herring population in the bay that disappeared about that time and never recovered.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, there is a lot of information on that spill. And of course, 15 years is quite a while.
That is quite a while.
Isn't it? Yeah. Absolutely. It's getting better, but that's still a long time.
Yeah, and the books, the studies that were completed were supposed to be mailed to us by Mr. John Van Mullen. Did you get them yet?
No, I haven't.
See, that's it. So
there may be a reason for that.
They're coming.
They are in Anchorage.
Okay. Yes.
Dave, you know when you're planning on visiting Olympic National Park?
We don't have a specific date. It's close for us. We can do it most any time, and the Admiral and I haven't really discussed that one.
Okay.
But it's certainly going to be, going to have to be November, I think, the earliest before we get there.
Okay. If possible, we'd like you to contact Park Service here in Anchorage, and maybe we can coordinate a trip down there.
Sure.
Because obviously that's a great interest to us.
Mm-hmm.
Both parks have been struck up here.
Well, I would really encourage that because as we get into how clean is clean, we certainly had some interesting discussions and negotiations with the Park Service down there. And
some of the Olympic crew has been involved in support to us up here on some of our activities this past summer. So I think it'd be a really important trip for all of us, and we could probably have some real good discussions down there.
Mm-hmm. A lot of the beach types down there are very characteristic of things that we've got here in the Sound. So,
will you come give us your name and phone number at the end of the meeting, please?
Sure.
For Tony.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
On the treated beaches, was there any signs of oil?
No. No, there weren't. The majority of the beaches had no signs of oil. As I mentioned, of the 75-some miles, maybe a half a mile or less, it still has the indications of oil in it. And those were very unique situations where there were low energy. And in fact, one area where we discussed with the oil subsurface and then some bleeding down the beach was, I don't know how best to describe it, but it was a little bay that had a small little opening that just slowly filled this bay up. There was no active energy at all. It was almost as if it were you could consider it a marsh, although it wasn't. But almost no energy there. And the other one was a unique beach also. So both the cases were quite unique, whether it was oil, but significant in the quantities of oil that were there. Yes, sir.
Did they clean both High Energy and Sheltered Bay?
Yes, they did. So in the areas that they cleaned.
All 75 miles.
No, the majority of them were not cleaned. So of the 75 miles that I'm referring to, half or better were not cleaned at all and recovered completely. Yes?
Did bunker seed come in and layer and
yes.
stay on the surface, or did it penetrate down through like it did?
Well, no, it penetrated. I mean, it was amazing. Some of the areas... I don't know that we could say 3 foot, but there was certainly penetration, several inches of penetration. But it was very, very heavy, thick, viscous stuff, and it just came ashore in huge quantities and big globules. It was, this thick some places where it came ashore, and already very viscous and thick when it hit the shore. So I would not say the penetration was probably as great, certainly not as great as, the initial shoreline impacts we received from the fresher oil here.
Apparently, one of their major forms of treatment on heavily oiled beaches there was to spray gasoline all over. I don't know if you talked about that.
No, he didn't.
Bunker on and set
no,
on fire.
Didn't talk about
but
that.
Apparently, they found out that that did even more damage than having just bunker seed.
Surprise, surprise.
That was leaded.
The shoreline that was naturally clean, I guess, for a number of years.
Well, they were experienced.
Do you think that happened because the soda tree was actually eroded during winter storms? Or do you feel that there was other processes?
I think that definitely had some part in it. I wouldn't say it was the only mechanism, but the area is very, very similar to here in a lot of respects in terms of the water temperatures and the kind of energy. They get huge storms that crash through there, and a lot of that area where really exposed area, I'm sure that was a good part of the process. Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Kennedy. Could you make that announcement, please?
One of the things we're trying to do here is compile a list of the various agencies and organizations, entities, if you will, that are going to be here in one way or another working with this spill over the winter. We would like to publish that list. If you all can provide us your mailing address, telephone number, and name of a contact person, we will compile all that and publish it and hand it out at the next meeting. Do you have those?
Yeah, everyone has a form, and I'll collect them right here at the stand.
Okay, great.
If you don't have a form, see Commander Winfrey, who gave the ops presentation. Are there any questions now from the audience to the panel? Oh.
I'd like to make a point. Yeah. I haven't heard yet. I'm Richard Sauer. I'm with the Anchorage office. Anybody that's going to be using vessels for your operations, now the larger folks I see more have this and know it, your vessels do have to meet Coast Guard regulations, and that varies depending on the size of the vessel. But you just simply can't go out and rent a local fisherman and have him take you and your party out. There are inspection requirements that have to be met, and our staff is more than happy to help you with those are and let you work it through. But know that there are regulations that have to be met for your safety for primary reason. Should you want to use a vessel that's not part of your organization already.
Thank you, Captain DeSero. Okay, as previously stated, the next meeting of this sort will be on 7 November, and I think we better consider maybe another location just so we can comfortably accommodate everyone. We did not realize it was going to be this large. And
well, any agencies here in Anchorage have a large conference room, meeting room that might be available?
Federal building on 8th and C, that one there? Okay.
First floor.
Terrific. Why don't we next time have, in fact, we will. The next meeting on 7 November will be at the Federal Building, first floor, 7 o'clock in the evening. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And we'll make sure it's available. And if it's not, we may change the date. Thank you very much for coming. Of the spill is after the wintering and weathering effects of it, what its consistency and what did those people use to clean it up and what was the impact to the environment. We have that to do, plus a number of other things, plus combining the inputs from different agencies, operational inputs from different agencies here, so that come 15 March, when I want to make a decision, or when I'm going to try to make a decision, weather permitting, out in the sound there, to get the people out there, to get the forces out there, and for Exxon to go out there with their forces and our forces to go on out, that we pretty much know what we are going to be facing. I hope to be at that stage at that time. And then knowing what we're going to be facing over here, pretty much figure out what type of equipment that we'll be able to use to combat whatever we're after. And also we'll know the locations, we'll know the degree of the coverage of the petroleum product, et cetera. So that's some of the stuff that, from an winter operations point of view, that I wanted to cover. Thanks, John.
One other item concerning this plan. This is a dynamic document, as are most plans, and we are in the process of coming up with a second edition, if you will. We're going to be making some revisions, because you will notice, you look through there, there were some areas that said to be developed. We hope to have this, and instead of sending a change out, we will probably just republish the plan in its entirety, similar to what you have there, with all of the updates in it at our next, and be able to distribute it at our next meeting.
So it's pretty important that if you have any comments, we're interested in it, and if we feel it can add to the information that's in there or change it accordingly, we'll be more than glad to do that before we promulgate the change. So I'm saying to you, if you got a change, get it in there as quickly as you can. Okay, thank you.
One question. Your plan calls for the formation of a winter interagency study coordination group. Thanks.
And do you have any idea when that committee would be formed?
I'm sorry, sir. Could you repeat the question?
Okay. Your plan calls for the formation of a winter interagency study coordination review committee. Is that formed already?
No. In fact, that is going to be headed up by the chief of staff, and Captain Dave Zawadzki, who is going to be in for the winter, will be heading that up.
That's me.
He's right there.
Been off for a couple of weeks, so it has not been formed, but it will be.
Dave, when are you going to do that, buddy? Have a feel?
The latter part of this month.
There. I couldn't give you the date.
We had another question back here.
Yeah. In light of the discussion earlier about sheens and reports of sheens, is it the Coast Guard's plan to actually to respond to all of these reports?
The Charlie.
They will all be assessed and evaluated one by one. Given the weather conditions, we are flying out there and verifying them. And yes, we'll respond and take appropriate action where necessary.
And what if they're verified and respond to the plan to try to clean them all up?
Within the capability of the equipment we have in the weather, yes, sir. We could have hypothetical questions, I guarantee you, all night long. But yes, if the weather's out there and oil's out there and the weather permits, yes, we would direct a cleanup by all means. It's not just go out to see the report and let it go on down. No, sir. It's all within the limitations of weather. And if anybody's sailed up here any time at all, we know how ugly it can get and how quickly it can get. So that would have to be evaluated more seriously.
And also the threat to the environment.
Yes, sir.
Does the threat exist?
Yes, sir. Anyone else? Anyone else have a question?
Go on.
Thank you.
Commander Gritwell.
Do you want to talk about the Southwest?
I just want to speak a couple minutes about the committee meetings for the winter plan. This is all outlined in the winter plan itself, as well as a letter that was sent out 28 September to all the ISCCs and MAP. And it's a three-page that we passed out that has a schedule on the last page. The schedule of committee meetings starts with the MACs and the ISCCs, and that the next scheduled minimum scheduled meeting is going to be on the 26th of October, and that would be, of course, in each of the four areas. Approximately 4 to 5 days after that, the chairman of the MAC or the ISCC, because it does vary from area to area, Homer has the MAC and the ISCC, Kodiak has the MAC and ISCC, Seward has the MAC and the RMAC, and Prince William Sound has an ISCC. So the chairman of each of those groups would meet with NOAA as the chairperson. So that would make it eight people from the field as well as the NOAA chairperson, and the next meeting for that is going to be on the 30th of October. The purpose of that particular committee, if you look at the letter that I passed out, is really twofold. The committee is called the Sector Coordination Group, and it's to act as a focal point for input to the FOSC, and through which the FOSC can take information and pass it back to the MACs and ISCC. So it's a lateral transfer of information among the four areas, Valdez, Kodiak, Seward, and Homer, as well as informing the FOSC. And the sole purpose is to facilitate communication. Then the last meeting after that is the Operations Steering Committee, which is made up, of course, of Exxon, DEC, and the Coast Guard. So it's basically the grassroots meeting first at the local MAC and ISCC, the head of the MAC and the ISCC, or MAC and RMAC in the case of Seward, meet 4 to 5 days later. A week after that, the Operations Steering Committee meets. I think there was a misperception, because we're having the last meeting basically first, that there was an attempt to cut out that first group of meetings, namely the grassroots level. That was not the intent. The schedule just worked out that way. Meaning the local?
The MACs and the ISCC, meaning in four towns.
I don't see any problem with that, whether you have it 4 days before or 3 days before. I don't think it's a mandatory meeting. That would be my opinion. As long as there's enough time for the chairman to get their comments to the SCG when that meets, the next meeting is the 30th of October.
Well, so are these dates set in concrete?
For the
format?
No. As long as they meet at enough time to where the chairman of the MAC and the ISCC, depending on where you're from, can get to the SCG. So
I'd re- well, note the note on the bottom, all dates and locations subject to confirmation.
Right.
It's
thank you, and it's meant to rotate, too, among the areas. The first one is in Anchorage, and then after that it's to rotate. So I would imagine that the eight people from the field, as well as the NOAA chairman, would decide on where it would be next, whether it be Homer the next time, and then Seward, and then Kodiak, Prince William Sound. But the first one's in Anchorage, and everyone after that is rotated.
I'd like to suggest in the air, in the atmosphere of cooperation, and maybe that this NOAA chair who will be doing the SCG visit each of the communities and meet with the MAC or ISCC before this meeting comes at the end of this month. Get a feel for each community before we come up and start to make our presentations in one big meeting.
Okay.
They might have a much better sensitivity for what's going on in each community.
Dave, did you hear that?
Is Dave Kennedy
Mr.
here?
Kennedy?
Yes, I did.
Oh, good.
Do you have any comment, Dave, on that?
Probably not a bad idea. I think we need to think about it. I don't think we had our personnel plan to try and do that, but we'll look at it. Probably not a bad idea.
We've lost our NOAA.
In Seward?
In Seward, yeah. I guess everywhere else, too.
Yeah.
So.
Kodiak has one for just another couple weeks, and then he comes up here. Any other questions or comments about the committee set up for the winter plan?
KISCC, or are you going to recognize the ESC, which is the Emergency Services Council, that's headed up by the city mayor?
What's the second group in Kodiak besides the
Emergency Services Council? It's a kind of a MAC group that has no status.
Captain Hartwell addressed that.
That was recognized. We just used MAC and ISCC, but the letter to Kodiak said Emergency Services Council and the other group is there. The ISCC is the other group there?
KISS.
No,
well, Kodiak Island.
We get so many.
It is KISS. There's a letter to KISS as is, and a letter to the Kodiak Emergency Services Council. We recognize you don't formally call it a MAC, but those are the two groups the letter went to.
It was sent out the 28th, and because of the mails, it's a possibility you don't even have it yet. I know we got a call Monday from Seward because they had not received their letter yet. But it was sent out to each of the four areas and would identify the two organizations, whether it was an ISCC or the RMAC or, in your case, the Emergency Services. So you may not even have gotten it as of today because of the mails. But it was sent out on the 28th.
Thanks, Will.
You're welcome.
The next item is the SAR posture for the Cordova Air Facility. To cover the search and rescue response in the Prince William Sound area, in light of all the operations that are going on there, boat operations, helicopter operations, we will assign an H-3 helicopter from the Kodiak Air Station to Cordova to remain there throughout the winter months. And the purpose of that helicopter will be primarily to support the Exxon Valdez operations in the Prince William Sound. And I have a minimum crew there to support this operation. It is not there because there is an extra heavy SAR load in the Cordova area. No, it's solely for Exxon Valdez operations. And when the operations are done for the day, and we will know because Exxon and ADEC and the other organizations will tell us what ops and aircraft and vessel operations are going on, we will stand down there. In the Western Alaska area, you will still be covered by the Kodiak Air Station plus all vessels that we have. The entire area of the 17th Coast Guard District will still function as we have in the past. And to give you an example, it was brought out today about the Steadfast tug. The tug Steadfast with his barge, it went down in severe weather. You had the H-3 out of Cordova respond immediately. You had an H-3 out of Kodiak respond. You had a C-130 out of Kodiak respond. And you had a vessel, I believe it was the Sedge, out of Homer, but I wouldn't swear to that. to respond. Sweetbriar out of Cordova respond to it. So there is plenty coming, and we'll help one another out. If somebody runs into a jam, the closest one to him in the sound will try to help him out as much as possible until some proper assistance can get there. And so that is the SAR posture, not only for the Cordova area, but also for really Western Alaska also. Any questions about that? Okay. The last person that I would like to have come up and give a presentation is Mr. Dave Kennedy, who represents from a federal government the scientific community. Dave is associated with NOAA.
My apologies for being late. I have a long, sad story, but I know none of you want to hear it. We have instituted already a winter studies program, which we have 18 stations within Prince William Sound we occupied in September. We intend to occupy those locations throughout the winter. We have a contractor hired now to make sure that those stations are occupied. Contractor has a number of other responsibilities, one of which for this group they should be aware of is a workshop to look at cleanup technology. We've advertised that we're going to do this at least to a small group earlier on. That workshop we are tentatively planning for November 28, 29, and 30 in Fairbanks, Alaska. It's going to be an invitation-only workshop. We're going to try and keep the group relatively small. But certainly all of the agencies that have been involved in this spill from the beginning will be invited and asked to have representation there. One of the things that probably we haven't discussed before we close down for the winter is a winter studies program that is going to take place outside of Prince William Sound. That program has been being developed over the last few weeks, and we are going to implement that in the Kodiak, Alaska Peninsula, and Kenai Peninsula area starting this month, and we'll periodically then do winter studies programs looking at the progress of the recovery of the beaches over the winter in those areas also. We also intend to go with Exxon periodically on some of their stations outside of Prince William Sound. At least to occupy and see what their stations look like as well and how those stations are progressing and what sort of work Exxon is doing. Admiral Cangolini mentioned some of the visits that he intends to make throughout the winter to some of these other locations. We intend to go with Admiral Cangolini on those trips. In fact, I don't know if you've discussed the Nova Scotia trip, but
I did not. I just mentioned that I went there, but why don't you, if you want to?
Just briefly, a couple of weeks ago, two or three weeks ago, Admiral Cangolini, myself, and an Exxon person did go to Chedabucto Bay in Nova Scotia to look at the Arrow spill, which happened almost 20 years ago. It's been fairly well studied over the 20 years. We were accompanied by one of the primary people who did some of those studies, John Vandemulen from the Bedford Institute of Oceanography in Halifax, Nova Scotia. He took us to several beaches that were his study sites to just give us an idea of what a million gallons of bunker C dumped into a fairly small area. I think the area that was actually impacted was about 75 miles or less. What those beaches looked like 20 years later. And it was an interesting undertaking. And one of the most interesting things is a couple of beaches we went to were still very heavily oiled. They had oil in a band, sometimes 2 or 3 meters wide. And in some places, oil, this is up in the upper tidal area, oil that was several inches thick.